I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Sam Wainwright.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. And you are one of the two board members for the Hilton Board of the City of Fremantle.
That's right.
Tell us, Sam, how long have you been involved in local government in Fremantle?
All right. Well, I was first elected to council in 2009, October 2009. So I guess that's coming on to 11 years now. And for people that aren't familiar with Hilton Ward, which is a bit of a funny beast in its own right, because the contrary to the name, the ward is essentially half of Hilton, all of O'Connor and all of Sampson. And it's that way because of the fact that the Local Government Act requires council wards to all have approximately the same number of residents within them. And I guess, you know, the drawing of ward boundaries probably starts from the centre and works outwards. And so Hilton Ward is kind of the leftovers at the end, really. So unfortunately, the wards don't... Hilton Ward is probably the most extreme expression, but the wards don't necessarily always naturally coincide with communities of interest, put it that way. What I'm trying to say is that Sampson has its own very, you know, distinct sort of identity.
Yes.
And then is put in with sort of half of Hilton and there's everything north of South Street. So it's a funny sort of a ward.
Yes.
Which then also takes in a lot of industrial areas as well. So it's got its particularity for sure.
But if you're looking for something which is along the lines of a microcosm of the city of Fremantle as a whole, then maybe the Hilton Board has it. It's got old Fremantle in Hilton, in that post-war suburb centre. It's got the new suburban area of Sampson. It's a little bit of Cardinia and got the O'Connor area with the light industrial and the like.
That's right. So it is quite mixed. And then it's also got the Hilton shops as well.
Yes.
Or part of them.
Part of them.
Half the Hilton shops.
It'll be... One half's what in the Beaconsfield.
That's right.
On the other side of the road where Charlie's is in your ward.
That's right. So everything north of South Street and east of Carrington is in Hilton Ward. So that's that pocket of residential Hilton behind the Hilton shops at the top of the hill there.
Yes.
And all of O'Connor. And then if you can imagine yourself heading east along South Street with all that industrial area on the left-hand side, there's a little pocket of houses on the left, just before South Street bottoms out, before it rises up to hit Stock Road. And that's where I live, Jarvis Street in O'Connor. And then there's O'Connor and that part of O'Connor and Sampson east of Stock Road.
I always wanted to find out how that little bit of residential in O'Connor there came to be there. Did it precede the light industrial, or were they always together?
Look, to be honest, I can't actually answer that question.
Seems incongruent in a way.
It is a bit. So really, my street, Jarvis Street, is the only one in that pocket of houses that has residential dwellings on both sides.
Yes.
Whereas the two adjacent streets, Stockdale and Chamberlain, have houses on one side and then industrial on the other. So we're well and truly surrounded by industrial zoned land usage, basically. But it's it's a nice quiet little pocket, basically. If people ask where I live, I often say Hilton, because if you say O'Connor, people think you live in a factory unit, but it is actually O'Connor there. Yeah.
Well, a lot of people who, when you say Hilton, do have connections. I've got family who grew up in Hilton. It was a post-war suburb. It seems to have been designed in that post-war period, and these days when we say post-war, there's so many younger people around, you have to think twice, don't you? The post-World War II period.
Yeah, which war?
Which war? And I think it's a post-Vietnam War. And in many ways, it is a post-Vietnam War place. But you've got a bit of a garden suburban development in that new planning sense. You've got public open space. You've got a little bit like you find in Canberra, sort of concentric circles, roads going in every direction.
That's right. So Hilton was interesting in that... I mean, first it was built quite rapidly after the Second World War. So it's, you know, it's an example of when Australian governments, and this is a different topic we can return to, but when Australian governments did actually invest heavily in public housing, because you have all these return soldiers. You know, people have suffered through the Great Depression and the war, victory against fascism, all these returning soldiers, people, you know, working people of Australia wanted the payoff. And they certainly didn't want to go back to the kind of housing they'd experienced during the Great Depression. So, we, you know, Hilton was built in, you know, in within that framework. So that's one thing that makes it interesting and gives it a very coherent sort of architectural form, in that except for the very eastern end of Hilton, it was all built, you know, very much planned with either the sort of timber kit homes or the asbestos houses, so built to a particular style, so it gives it that coherent form and why it has its own particular heritage protections. But it was also interesting because it was very much shaped by what was known as the British town planning movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was a sort of post-war, you know, progressive town planning movement that very much had the idea that, you know, working class people could be happy, you know, if they lived in nice surrounds. And so that whole idea of the school being at the centre of the suburb, it being a garden suburb, all the trees, the fact that you've got, you know, trees down every side of every street, a footpath on both sides, that kind of thing, was very much influenced by that. And I think there's a lot to recommend it.
Well, I was going to say there is a lot to recommend it. Just as an aside, my father was the principal of the Hilton Primary School once upon a time. So I got to know it at a number of levels, Hilton. But do you think that planning has an impact on the community today?
I think it does, you know, because it's an urban form which is designed to encourage pedestrian activity, for example.
Yes.
So you look at a suburb like Hilton, there is a footpath down every side of every street and a street tree for every property.
And it doesn't have a big something like South Street going through the middle of it, which segments the suburb into different areas. There's a couple of main streets, but they're not overly wild, are they?
No, that's very true. And I mean, I've had a lot of time, you know, while I don't come from a sort of an urban planning sort of background myself, I've done a lot of letterboxing in my time. I've been a candidate for elections more times than most people run for a bus. So that also means I've done a lot of letterboxing and a lot of time to just sort of soak up and feel urban form. And it's very noticeable that as soon as you cross Stock Road and go into South Street, you see where by the time you start pushing into the 70s and 1980s, urban planners decided that we don't need footpaths anymore. And you get the mania for cul-de-sacs, streets without footpaths or street trees. And there was nothing particularly to recommend that new urban form relative to the one that you see in a place like Hilton or Beaconsfield, other than it was quicker and cheaper for developers to do it that way. And
many of them were smaller lots as well.
With smaller lots. I mean, Sampson is still, the lots are still reasonably generous, you know, so it's not like the suburbia that you see on the fringes of Perth now, where the lots are very, you know, quite small and the houses are very big. So, you know, in Sampson, I would say, still kind of reflects a sort of a traditional Australian suburbia where the backyards are still big enough to kick a footy or run chooks or have a veggie garden, that kind of thing. But unfortunately, this mania for, you know, cul-de-sacs, not putting in footpaths, not putting in street trees had well and truly taken hold. And so it's something that, from a City of Fremantle perspective, we actually have to reverse some of that, you know. Mm. It's interesting, you know, real studies, you know, of urban form show that sort of higgledy-piggledy cul-de-sac kind of design, which, you know, became all the sort of rage in the kind of 80s and into the 90s.
I think it's the opening pictures for the television series Neighbours.
Yeah, exactly right, that sort of thing. You know, people have this idea that, oh, they'll be sort of safer, you know, but of course they're actually not safer. The traditional grid layer of a street is actually activates streets better because they're better for pedestrian access, because pedestrians have much more direct connection. Mm. And so there's much more passive surveillance and the through traffic and all that kind of thing. So contrary to people's expectations, those sort of higgledy-piggledy...
they work.
Sort of things don't work. And the grid works better.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
The other thing that you then have to do if you create If you design a suburb the way Sampson was designed, is then you have to do to facilitate pedestrian connections. You need then need these laneways at the end of
yes.
of cul-de-sacs, which have less passive surveillance, so people feel uncomfortable using them at night.
They're very uncomfortable.
That's right, and the neighbours who immediately adjoin them often want them closed because they see them as the cause of antisocial behaviour, whether it's serious, you know, things like robbery or yes. you know, just kids mucking up. It's real. And so then councils are then forced with difficult, trying to balance competing interests of people who want to be able to walk up to the bus stop
yes.
and not be forced to take a 500 metre detour versus the residents who are sick of, you know, kids yeah. throwing rocks over their back fence, that kind of thing. So they just, they were a bad idea, but we can't, you know, we can't turn back the clock. So,
but the interesting thing is when you raise those sorts of issues and start to think about them at least and then wonder just what you were saying. Are there ways of addressing them? You can deal with trees. Different groups of people will come in with different requirements for living. I mean, just look at how Hilton, in so many ways, old Hilton has sort of been reborn as a suburb, and the design of houses and the degree of vegetation in the place. I mean, that conceivably can happen anywhere.
I think it could, and. Yeah, I mean, while there's, you know, there's limits to which you can change the form of a place like Sampson, one thing that I'm very glad to have been associated with is the push by City of Fremantle to get street trees into Sampson.
Yes.
A few years ago, we did, when I say we, I mean the City commissioned consultants to do heat mapping of Fremantle. And, you know, apart from places like South Fremantle right next to the coast, you know, Hilton was one of the coolest suburbs because of its tree coverage. And Sampson, on an average January day, was like 1.5 degrees hotter.
Was it? Yeah. You know,
taking out Sampson Park itself, but Sampson, the suburban, you know, the built-up part of Sampson was like 1.5 degrees hotter, which is quite a lot. But we have since subsequently been putting in street trees. So Sampson was mapped for all the locations street trees could go in. Residents were surveyed to ask if they'd like a street tree. So it was done in a sort of opt-out kind of basis that, you know, unless you say no, you will be getting a street tree. And there was very few residents that actually consciously opted out. And very few of the street trees that were put in have subsequently been removed, let's say. So that's addressing all of those issues. I think so, and I think there is a bit of a generational change, and people recognising that they need street trees. You know, and if you're going to make, if you're going to create walkable suburbs in a Perth summer, then you do actually need
a tree,
that shade canopy. I mean, there's other, you know.
Let me just ask this. I go to play pickleball in the Sampson Recreation Centre. And I'll tell you what pickleball is later because people normally haven't heard of it. But right next to it, there used to be shops in Sampson, which are no longer there. So I suppose whether it's Hilton or Sampson or Beaconsfield or Whitecombe Valley, interesting questions arise whether people want their own mini town centres, I suppose.
That's right. And for Sampson, that's a really vexed question, the lack of shops. For people that aren't familiar, that site where the shops were, I mean, the shop is demolished, so it's a vacant lot now.
Yes.
And there is a valid development approval for a development at that location, which is essentially apartments, multi-storey apartments, with retail on the ground floor, with a sort of cafe approved on the ground floor. And unfortunately, it just hasn't happened. The proponent has asked for an extension. But look, I don't know. I can only guess that they didn't meet their target for pre-sales to trigger. So it's unfortunate that it sat there unused. And it's also unfortunate that that a shop just hasn't survived. Survived there, I think.
Guess that's because they're this is the whole planning study of where you put shops and how many you can have, and regional shopping centres and local ones, and people aren't that far from Fremantle, or they're not that far from the Hilton shops, and so, or they can go in another direction altogether. So it's probably hard to survive commercially.
Look, I think it probably is a difficult commercial proposition, and you know, you can imagine if you're a small independent retailer there, and people are doing the majority of their shopping at the big supermarkets.
Yes.
Sure, they'll find you handy, you know, just to grab a litre of milk when they run out of milk, yes, kind of thing. But as that small corner store operator, you're probably making barely any margin,
yes,
you know, on milk. And so the sort of convenience, you know, you really need people to not, yeah, just buy milk, but buy something else while they're at it, you know, that you, yeah, actually make a little bit more on, because you're trying to, you know, you're virtually selling your milk, you know, at cost price, just because people are used to buying, yeah, buying it for a dollar a litre and at Coles or Woolworths. So I think
it's a tough one.
It's a tough one, you know. So it does mean that Samsung people will, you know, get in their cars and drive to, yes, to Hilton or Kubalap or Cardinia to do their shopping. But it is a real problem too, because there's, you know, there's the seniors village just adjacent. So there, you know, there's a decent body of people who either don't drive or, you know, would rather not, kind of thing, and a reasonable kind of density around there. And it's a pity that hasn't been enough to sustain.
You'd think it's a captive shopping audience, but it's probably more problematic than you think.
That's right.
Just bearing all of those issues in mind, can I ask you, when you first decided to run for the ward, you've been in the same ward the whole time since 2009, is that right?
That's right.
And what was it that motivated you to run for council, and were there particular issues in the ward that you were wanting to pursue?
Look, yes, there were, and all through my 20s, because I was 29 when I got elected to council, I'd been an activist, you know, around a whole range of social and environmental issues.
Well, I think
issues.
You stood for federal parliament.
I had a few times as well. And look, when I was growing up, my family moved around a lot, so I don't really actually have a genuine sense of hometown. But I came to Western Australia in 2003 with my partner Janet, and a year or two after her father had died, and she wanted to be near her mum. And I always said to her, look, you know, if you want to come back to Western Australia sometime, then that's fine. Anyway, she took me up on the offer sooner than I expected. And, you know, if you'd asked me when I was 23, when I was an enthusiastic activist campaigning on a whole range of different issues, whether I'd ever want to run for council, I would have sort of laughed at you. But when you have moved around a lot, but for once actually make a place your home and anticipate being there for a while, you actually wanting to make change where you live starts to become more important. You know, not just the big sort of national or global issues.
A sense of community.
That's right. That becomes important to you, and you start to notice things. And I've always been very passionate about environmental issues and sustainable transport, and that's sort of where I've come to the question of urban form, and been a very keen cyclist. And so, it's the thing that those sorts of questions of, you know, why the hell isn't there a bike lane on this street, or why are pedestrians made to cross three sides of this intersection rather than one side? They actually start to really stick in your craw, and they were the sorts of things that motivated me to put my hand up for council in 2009. Okay.
And just take a couple of those issues. They're one and the same, or very closely related: sustainable transport and cycling. Have we got close to where you think we ought to be?
I don't think we're anywhere near where we want to be. But having said that, Fremantle has made significant progress. So,
what would you like to see? You probably need to break it down into chunks for you as you look at the city of Fremantle.
Well, I mean the goal, yes, the sort of maximum goal is that it should be safe and practical to ride a bicycle from the front door of any one business or residence in Fremantle to any other business or residence.
Yes.
So our job will not be done until that is possible.
Yes.
And so we're still far from that, far, far from that. Having said that, though, real progress has been made. So it's all the real objective data that we've been able to get our hands on, and we're limited in our capacity. But there's the census data is particularly useful. Obviously, the census only happens, what is it, every 5 years? So,
yes.
But the last census did show us, the last two have shown a significant increase in cycling in Fremantle.
And COVID, of course, has produced a
COVID has
a lot of bicycle sales, whether or not everyone's riding them.
No, that's right. And whether it lasts, that remains to be seen as well. But no, in Fremantle, we have seen a real marked rise in cycling. Now, when I got elected to council in 2009, the city's annual cycling infrastructure budget was about $39,000 a year, which, you know, buys you a few bike rails, that's about it, kind of thing. And for most of the years subsequent, the spend has been closer to the $400,000 mark. And so that has been enough to start to make a qualitative difference. Not everywhere overnight, and there are some, you know, there are some roads, for instance, where a classic one is Carrington Street, where unless the state government is prepared to come to the party and substantially co-fund the works, that, you know, you're just looking at the tens of millions of dollars, and so it's very hard for the city of Fremantle to be able to attempt making a street like that bicycle friendly.
Not like that, but there's a lot of sort of infilling, I suppose.
Yeah, but there's, you know, there's bits and pieces that we've been able to do. Some, you know, things which are still significant to our budget. They wouldn't be significant in a main roads budget, but they're significant in the context of our budget, where we've started to make it real, to make it possible. And just anecdotally, you see that, you know, you feel it when you come into Fremantle.
Yeah. Well, Fremantle, the centre of Fremantle, the CBD, is now all painted up with cycle symbols up and down and everywhere. And I have to say, I feel, as an older rider on my bike going into Fremantle, which I do quite a bit, a lot safer now. I feel as if I've got a right to be on the road, and I feel as if I'm respected by the motorised traffic. I don't feel as if I have to put myself into a dangerous position to let them rush by me. But it's all about getting appropriate separation of bike lanes in most situations, isn't it? I've sort of made an informal study of Scandinavian approaches to these things, where they've got deaths from cycling down to pretty close to zero and the like.
Yes, look, I think with, as a passionate advocate for cycling, I would say that it's important not to be kind of dogmatic or fixed on any particular kind of treatment. The important thing is the goal, and how you get there is secondary. So there are going to be some, and what that means is that there are some environments where you need separation. That is to say, bike lanes or bike paths, to make people feel safe, and that is particularly true on, you know, on any road environment where speeds are above 40 kilometres an hour. But there are going to be other environments where you actually want to encourage cyclists to claim the lane and for everyone to share to share the road. And like you say, in parts of inner the Fremantle CBD, we're sort of creating that environment where, you know, it's 40 kilometres an hour. You should only be driving at the speed of a bike anyway. And so in that context...
I'm not sure that I ride that fast.
Okay, sure.
But I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. That's just the environment, you know. And if, you know, and people need to respect that environment, you know. But as soon as you start, you know, as soon as you're on main distributor roads, then you need separation.
I take your point that excusing the terrible similar horses for courses, but it's going to depend on a lot of things, what you can achieve. But can I just ask you this, and we'll get to some other issues as well that we need to talk about, I think. But the impact, is there one of e-bikes, electric bikes?
I think they actually do have the potential to really be quite revolutionary, you know, in the sense that they make it possible for people who aren't sort of, you know, cycling nuts like I am, to conquer hills and to ride a lot further. And also to keep up with slow moving traffic, and thus to integrate themselves into the traffic flow, and to further what we were talking about before of just normalising cyclists as just part of the traffic flow, and not something, if you're sitting behind the wheel of a car, not for you to get annoyed by, but just to accept.
So they're not to be treated like I would often do, treat electric or whatever, motorised skateboard riders, who seem to me to be almost a, they're very entertaining, but almost a nuisance when they decide to take the centre of the road up and go this way and go there.
Look, I think, I mean, I, you know, I'm very big on, you know, as a cyclist, I have a right to be on the road and to occupy the lane if I feel it's necessary for me to do so.
Yes.
But then I obey the road rules, you know, pretty scrupulously, for that reason. I think